Welcome back to Solve Crimes with Rick and Gavin. I'm Gavin Fish. Today we're continuing Treated Like Trash, our investigation into the 2008 death of 20-year-old Amanda Winkowski. If you're new to our show, you can catch up on everything by going to our website, solvecrimeswithrickandgavin.com. There you can find video, audio, images, documentation, news clippings, and so forth. If you're on YouTube, you can catch up by watching videos number 12 and 13. And if you're listening on the podcast, they're episodes 9 and 10. Today, we're going to take a closer look at our number one suspect in this case, Antoine Garner. So we hope you'll stick around. This is Solve Crimes. Before we go too far down this rabbit hole, I want to check in with Rick, talk about listener and viewer comments. Rick, what do you have for us today?
We have a couple of good ones. So one that we've gotten on other other episodes and cases that we're working on as well, but definitely a lot on this case. The question is, how can people help? I mean, we're not just playing this, talking about a man's case without. You know, we actually do have goals on as far as things we want to
solve this case, right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
So, and the answer to that question, as far as how you can help, is to sign up for Amanda's Army.
Yeah. Amanda's Army is basically an email list that we're putting together. You can go to our website, solvecrimeswithrickandgavin.com, go to Amanda's case page, and there's a button right up at the top that says join Amanda's Army. But what are we going to
do with
that
link
list?
In the comment section on the YouTube page as well.
Yeah.
So, and essentially, as we find things that we can figure out that we can delegate, things that we don't have to do, basically we'll be putting the requests out on that list. So the first thing you can do to help us out is to get yourself on that list and open those emails and read them when we send them out.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not even things that we can't do or don't want to do. It's the things that we're going cross-eyed doing. We have 1800 pages of documents here. Just this week, Rick, as you know, we activated Amanda's Army to help us look through the autopsy reports.
That's
so
right.
On our website, on Amanda's case page, you can actually read Dr. Vertis's autopsy report and then Dr. Comparini's autopsy report, along with Dr. Hoffman's toxicology opinion.
And we should probably just reiterate, I think you're more qualified to do this on this case than I am. Why don't you reiterate our goal for this particular case? Because we kind of know who did it.
Yeah, this is a case where it's kind of obvious who the guilty parties are, but they can't be prosecuted or at least haven't been prosecuted because the original ME, her name is Dr. Diane Vertis, she ruled Amanda's death not as a homicide. She ruled it as an acute opioid overdose. Right. So an accidental
overdose. Immediately stopped Buffalo PD.
Yeah. Up until that moment, Buffalo PD had like a very good investigation going. Mm-hmm. Very good investigation going. Well documented. And as soon as that report came out, the DA at the time was just like, we can't prosecute an accident. Done.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the ultimate goal is to, I mean, I'm just trying to make it so that people understand what our ultimate goal is. So our ultimate goal is to basically put pressure on the Erie County Medical Examiner's Office to either look again or to ultimately change their findings, right?
Yeah, we need those findings changed from accidental overdose to homicide. Right. Once that happens, then Buffalo PD can do the job that they've been wanting to do all along, right? They can they can investigate and hopefully get a case together that's prosecutable so that the DA's office can then indict.
That's our goal. So far, it seems that that is the last thing that the ME's office wants to do. It seems that they just want this thing swept under the rug and forgotten about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So terrible. That's kind of our job, is to not let that happen.
That's correct. Yep. What other questions we have out there?
Let's see. The next question we have is when we're going to come out with new episodes, which, you know, the answer to that is this one. First off.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But we're, you know, we have a fine line that we have to balance with all of these cases. We don't just want to spit out little bits of information. I mean, our ultimate goal is to make these videos watchable and, you know, where people want to watch them and get into it. And so it does take a lot of preparation. So we try and not release a video until we have something solid to present, right?
Yeah. And we're doing it real time. A lot of YouTube shows or podcasts, they will work for a year on something and then release every Monday, you know, until they've got all their stuff out. We're right. Not doing that. We're doing this real time as we, yep. As we investigate a certain angle of the case and we learn something new, we put that together into an episode and then we publish it.
And that's what people don't see, the behind the scenes where you and I are on the phone with each other every day saying, you know, I think I got enough for another episode. Do you? Oh yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Maybe we need a little more, you know, that kind of thing.
So. Yeah. And we have people that we're working with, you know, our Matthew Gruel, for example, Dr. Gruel is helping us with DNA. Dr. Yep. Olmsted is helping us with pathology. Detective Cefalu is helping us with other questions that have to do with police work. And yep. Then Leslie has assembled a ragtag group of ne'er-do-wells that is working hard on our behalf too. People who yep. are former prosecutors and things like that. They're
and
helping
all
us
all of
too.
The stuff that you're mentioning, all of that stuff takes time, you know. And oh, by sure the does. Way, we have jobs and yeah. businesses that we run. Yeah. So it's a lot of work.
So yeah, the short answer is we'll get them out as quickly as we can.
Yeah.
With the caveat that we want a very good episode for you. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Great. Thanks, Rick. Antoine Garner is currently serving an 18-year sentence at Elmira Correctional Facility, which is in Elmira, New York. His earliest release date, according to the New York State Department of Corrections, is February 13th, 2027. Now, Antoine was convicted of 4 felonies: robbery, criminal sexual act, rape, and strangulation. The Department of Corrections website also says that they only show the 4 crimes with the longest sentences, so there might be other crimes he was convicted of or pled guilty to. We're not sure. We're working on getting those court records. But for today, we want to focus on those last 2 listed by the Department of Corrections, rape and strangulation. When Amanda's mom, Leslie Brill Meserol, talked to the mayor of Buffalo, Byron Brown, about Amanda's case, she said Mayor Brown asked her, quote, "What was a white girl from the suburbs doing in the inner city?" Well, that's a good question. Not a terribly tactful or caring question, but a good one. So let's find out a little bit about Buffalo's East Side.
And that's why I just don't think Amanda was stupid enough to mess with the East Side. I just don't get it. Like, we were scared of the East Side. We knew to be scared of the East Side.
This is Danielle Winkowski, Amanda's sister. They were both addicted to heroin, so they would often buy and do drugs together.
It's just a scary place around here. Like, even us being street smart and like being like using drugs for years and like being down in the hood, like the West Side does not compare to the East Side. Like, there's shootings and killings and rapings and like just they're just scarier down there. Like, you just knew not to mess with I would never. And that was the first thing I said to Adam when he told me he took her to get drugs and she never came back out. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, I took her to get drugs and she never came back out. And I'm like, where? And he's like, on the East Side. I'm like, no, you didn't. We have no dealers on the East Side. We wouldn't go to the East Side. And that's what I did. That's what I did. She went in and she never came back out. And that's what he kept telling me. And I was just like, we don't know anybody on the East Side. Like, there's no dealers on the East Side. We don't know anybody on the East Side. Like, we don't mess with the East Side. Like, that's a whole nother ball game. Like, that's just something you don't do. And especially as a young, pretty white girl. Like, you know not to mess down there. You know what I mean? Well, you don't know what I mean, but that's how we look at it. Like, you just know it's a scary place to be, and especially as one of us. Like, you, even being as stupid as we are, we just know that you just don't do it. It's just like a common street thing, you know. You just don't go to the east side.
Buffalo's east side is a very dangerous place, especially for a person like Amanda Winkowski. And people don't put themselves into dangerous situations on purpose without weighing the risk-reward. Whatever reward Amanda was seeking that night, December 5th, 2008, she apparently was willing to take the risk. And there are a couple of scenarios that would seem to make sense. One of them is that Amanda went to Antoine's house to buy drugs. Amanda was an addict and Antoine was a drug dealer. But he didn't deal heroin, which was Amanda's drug of choice. And there were plenty of drug dealers in Niagara Falls that she could have gone to. They were closer to her. She knew them. So why would she choose to go see Antoine under this scenario? It's questionable. But we do know from various witnesses that Amanda was acting as a police informant. So it's possible she went in that capacity. Amanda was an addict. She probably had run-ins with police. And she had a boyfriend, Ryan Paces, who was in jail at the time. And according to her family, she believed she could earn a lighter sentence for him by cooperating with the law. Now, here's what Ryan Paces actually had to say about that.
So it didn't work. You know, what I heard of, it didn't work. It never worked towards me. You know, she would have done anything to get me out of jail. But they always said, it's not going to work. I'm on a violation of parole. They didn't want me. They wanted, you know, it wouldn't have worked. They kept saying, it's not going to work to her. It's not going to work to her. And then I let it go. But that's how Amanda was, man. It was a different level. It was a different level of love. I mean, it was pure. You know what I mean?
We'd like to welcome to the show Joe Cefalu. Joe is a 25-year veteran of police force in the Bay Area of Northern California. Worked on homicides, worked on cold cases. He's our go-to guy when we have questions about the police. How you doing, Joe?
Great. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing good, doing good. So we've been going over a couple of the facts of the Amanda Winkowski case. And one of the things that we keep coming back to is, why was Amanda in the place that she was at the time that she was? The east side of Buffalo apparently is a very dangerous place, and a place that Amanda and her sister Danielle, even though they were both addicted to heroin and there were drug dealers that they could go to get heroin down there, they never would. And yet Amanda was found herself on the east side of Buffalo. And we believe, or Danielle believes and her family believes, that she was a confidential informant for a drug task force in the area. So my question for you is that something that a drug task force would do to an informant, put her in danger, purposefully by putting her in a place where she probably was in more danger than she otherwise would be?
Not intentionally, no. But if she was there, if they sent her there to do a buy, then they would be there. They would meet with her beforehand. They would, make sure she didn't have any drugs on her person at that time. They would give her the marked buy money. They would send her in to make the buy. They would usually have a wire on her. They would listen to what's going on. There would be a bus signal, or if they were doing a controlled buy, which meaning she would go in and then come out and give them the drugs, they would be listening the whole time. And there'd be a team of them. It wouldn't be just one or two. Probably the half of the task force would be there because it's a dangerous area. And then there would be some type of safe word. So if she felt like she was in danger, she would give a word and they would go in and try to rescue her. So they wouldn't just say, here's some money, go buy some drugs and come back later when you're done. That just doesn't, that doesn't happen that way.
How far away would they be? I can't imagine
Buffalo. Within the neighborhood, with close enough to be able to respond to get into the house to rescue her if she needed it, and enough for the wire to pick it up too. So we were talking 2007 technology. It was probably in something, you know, I don't know. Could be in any. They hide them in any kind of device, but that's usually how it goes.
Danielle said that when she did buys, the wire was in like a cigarette lighter.
Mm-hmm. That's about right.
Yeah.
Back in those days, yeah.
Now, are there places where, I mean, are there circumstances where they wouldn't be able to hide somewhere nearby, like they'd give themselves away, or, you know, the neighborhood would know or something like that? Does that ever happen?
Sure. Yeah. It just depends on what kind of, you know, if the cars they're driving would stick out in a neighborhood, or the officers themselves didn't match the population that lived in that area, then of course it would be, you know, more difficult. And in some neighborhoods, they know right away every car that comes in the neighborhood, and they'll start whistling and, you know, alerting, hey, cops are right there. So it really depends. It does, but they wouldn't just let her go in by herself without having some type of tactical plan to go in and get her if she needed help.
So it's sounding like the odds are that she was somehow lured there or taken there that night.
Yeah.
Doing a police, you know, buy.
Right. I would tend to say probably not. If you have an informant, that has to be cleared. Yeah, they have to sign up with the task force. So if it's a legitimate task force in that area, there's usually paperwork that needs to be signed, and you have to follow a certain amount of rules. You can't do drugs. You can't go buy drugs on your own. You can't commit any crimes. You can't go to jail, because if she was an informant, it usually is you're working off a case, right? They have something over your head that you're trying to work off so you don't have to go to jail.
Right.
So there's all those rules that are set up for that purpose. So you're just not running around with basically a get out of jail free card, right? Oh, look, I'm in for, I can do whatever I want.
Mm.
Now, does that happen? It happens all the time. It happens all the time that the informants go rogue and do whatever they want to do. But it's really up to the agents to manage that. So if she was there on their behalf, they would have been somewhere nearby with a plan.
Okay. So Amanda found herself in a very dangerous part of town, with very dangerous people doing very dangerous things. Things that resulted ultimately in her death. So let's fast forward to after Amanda's body was found, and let me give you the 30,000 foot highlights. Amanda was found in a garbage can across the street from Antoine Garner's house on January 9th, 2009. That was 35 days after she was last seen alive. She was frozen solid. On January 10th, Erie County Medical Examiner Diane Verdes conducted an autopsy on Amanda's body. According to reports in the police files, Dr. Verdes left Amanda's body out overnight to thaw her prior to the autopsy. And this is not a proper procedure according to several studies on the subject. What Dr. Verdes should have done was to bring Amanda's temperature down over a long period of time, about a week, in a refrigerator prior to conducting the autopsy. The way she did it, the outside of Amanda's body would have begun to decompose while her organs were still frozen inside. The decision to autopsy Amanda the day after she was discovered is an indication that the Erie County Medical Examiner's office was overworked, understaffed, and hurried. That's my opinion anyway. On January 27, 2009, the Erie County Medical Examiner's office received a toxicology report from the Forensic Toxicology Lab. It reported the following substances in Amanda's body: 12.6 micrograms per liter of cannabinoids in her blood, 0.08 milligrams per liter of morphine in her blood, 0.20 milligrams per kilogram of morphine in her liver, less than 0.02 milligrams per liter of codeine in her blood, less than 0.06 milligrams per kilogram of codeine in her liver, and 0.03% weight by volume of ethanol in her blood and urine. On February 5th, 2009, the Erie County Medical Examiner's Office issued its autopsy report. It determined that Amanda Winkowski died of an accidental opioid overdose. On March 7, 2009, the Erie County Forensics Lab delivered its DNA analysis report to the medical examiner's office. It found DNA from at least three people inside Amanda's mouth, one of which was Adam Patterson. Amanda herself is likely one of the other people, leaving an unknown male as the third. Antoine Garner's DNA is not found in any of the samples sent to the lab in this report. On April 6, 2009, the Erie County Forensics Lab produced a supplemental toxicology report. In it, they found 10.7 milligrams per liter of gamma-hydroxybutyrate in a sample of Amanda's blood, 17.6 milligrams per liter of GHB in a sample of Amanda's bile, 18 milligrams per liter of GHB in a second sample of Amanda's bile. Now, GHB is more commonly known as the date rape drug. June 2, 2009, Amanda's mom is advised by a member of a local police agency to have Amanda's body exhumed and examined by an outside ME. She ultimately decides to do it, and the report that she got back said that Amanda was definitely murdered. On June 15, 2009, the Erie County Forensics Lab delivers a supplemental DNA analysis report. In it, Antoine Garner is matched to a hair found on Amanda's buttocks. A hair from Amanda's back is determined to be from an unknown female. Another hair from Amanda's back is determined to contain DNA from two additional unknown persons. On December 14, 2009, Amanda's body was flown to Los Angeles, California, to be examined by a private medical examiner, Dr. Sylvia Comparini. Her body is accompanied by Leslie's friend, Kathy Wepner, and a retired Buffalo PD detective, Dennis Delano. On November 15, 2011, almost 2 years later, and after multiple legal battles with Erie County, Dr. Comparini finally has access to the tissue samples that Erie County inexplicably withheld from her. Yes, they withheld evidence from Dr. Comparini and fought to keep it from her. Anyway, she issued her autopsy report, finding Amanda's cause of death was manual strangulation associated with blunt force injuries of face, tongue, external genitalia, upper and lower extremities. In a future episode, we're going to take a closer look at both autopsy reports, but for now I want to talk to Rick about the drugs that were in Amanda's system. I think a lot of people might get hung up on this, just like the original medical examiner, Dr. Verdes. And Rick has been reading a toxicological interpretation, which is a document that was prepared by Dr. Donald B. Hoffman, who was asked to give his opinion on the amount of drugs in Amanda's body. Rick, can you tell us what you found out?
Well, Dr. Hoffman was hired by the family, by Amanda's family, to basically for his expertise and his opinion on the toxicology report that was done by the Erie County ME's office, right? Mm-hmm. So his opinion is very different from a full-blown autopsy report where they're discussing, you know, physical things on the body. He is an expert in toxicology only, and that is what he gave his opinion on. So his information in there, when you read it, it's very obvious. He basically scoffs at the finding from the ME's office in Erie County. He just says there's not enough of anything in there, even the combination of everything in there, even though there's a little bit of everything, it's basically a giant cocktail, unfortunately, but it was not enough to kill her. I mean, he knew her body type and her weight and all that stuff. And that was his whole career. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. So, and by the way, we ought to tell people this report from Dr. Hoffman is available on our website, solvecrimeswithrickandgavin.com. Right. If you go to Amanda's case page, you can take a look at the document that we're talking about here.
Yeah. And he explains, you know, what he didn't just put a paragraph about his findings. He explains in there about certain things that he found, reading the toxicology report. And he said, you know, there was this and there was that, but it's not enough to kill a person. And there was this and there was that, and this could be residual from this and, you know, that kind of thing. He explains very clearly. So people can go check it out on our website.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to Antoine Garner. In the legal world, there's this phrase, modus operandi, or MO. It refers to a pattern of behavior so distinctive that separate crimes are recognized as the work of the same person. And remember, Antoine was convicted, again, among other things, of raping and strangling a woman. But was this the first time he'd ever raped, attempted to rape, and or strangled a woman? The answer is no. The first time we can find Antoine getting caught attempting a sexual crime, it was in the locker room of his North Buffalo High School back in 2002. He was only 16 years old, but he was already 6'3" and 252 pounds. In a report, it says he grabbed a 14-year-old freshman girl by the neck and shoulder, threw her up against a wall or gate, and sexually attacked her. The girl was able to escape, and after telling an adult, Antoine was arrested and charged. This wasn't the only time he sexually assaulted a girl when he was a teenager. Unfortunately, those records are sealed, so we don't know the details of the second case. We only know about it because of a footnote in a later case. On YouTube, we'll leave a link to that article in the video description. And if you're listening on the podcast, you can go to our website and read about it. The third case that we know about happened in October 2008, when a home healthcare worker named Celeste Cerisi entered an abandoned house with Antoine Garner. She had been brought to that house by a friend, a man, who said she'd be fine and he'd be right back. Then he drove off. Sound familiar? Celeste thought that she was going to a party with other people inside the house, but instead, she was raped and almost killed by strangulation. In her conversation with police after the assault, Celeste told them he is going to kill someone. She insisted that the police arrest Antoine Garner, but they didn't. And it's hard to tell why they didn't. The investigation just didn't seem to go anywhere until, just as Celeste said, Amanda was killed. And it was at that point that Antoine Garner was arrested and tried for the assault on Celeste Cerisi. He was acquitted. Now, this is the assault Rick and I have the most information about because we've actually spoken to Celeste. She shared in great detail the story of Antoine assaulting her and raping her. She told us just how she was able to get away. And though we recorded her telling us what happened, we decided not to share it on this episode. She's given us permission to share it, but we just don't think now is the right time. We find her very credible, and we believe her. The jury, though, apparently did not. In 2011, Garner was tried and convicted of raping and strangling an unnamed victim. During the trial, she described how 6'4", 387-pound Garner lifted her 5'4", 135-pound body off of the ground by the neck. Garner choked this woman until she lost consciousness. Then he struck her with a blunt object. This all happened inside a vacant house. When she woke up, she was on her stomach. Garner was on top of her. After he was done, he left the house. This unnamed victim staggered outside and collapsed on the steps of a nearby home. A neighbor called 911. He was eventually convicted of strangulation and assault. Apparently, the jury assembled for that trial believed the victim more than the previous jury had believed Celeste Cerisi. In 2013, Garner pleaded guilty to 3 counts of third-degree rape and 3 counts of third-degree criminal sexual act for the raping and sodomizing of a 16-year-old girl and impregnating her. This all came to light when in 2011, the victim filed a paternity suit against Garner when she was 19 years old. It turns out that Garner was raping and sodomizing her between December 2008 and January 2009. This is the time frame when Amanda Winkowski was murdered, hidden, and later discovered. So that's five separate times that Antoine Garner was accused of or convicted of raping, strangling girls and women.
I mean, what can you say? I mean, this guy is quite literally a menace to society. I mean, his MO is he's a menace. I mean, he does not care about anyone else but himself. It's clearly his instinct. You know, I mean, the guy's a big dude. I mean, you know, Gavin, you and I have talked about this. If he grabbed either of us by the neck, we're done.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was a menace.
Like, I'm not a little person, but.
Right.
But if he got me, I'd be done.
Yeah. And I have to think, I mean, you know, we both have daughters. While I'm thinking of all the things that we know about of the accusations and the, you know, court cases and arrests, I have to think that there are plenty more that never said anything because the dude's intimidating, you know,
yeah.
And I'm sure that he threatens very well and he probably doesn't even have to threaten to be intimidating.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. There were two cases that we know about when he was a teenager. We have been told, though we're not able to verify it because it's sealed. He was a right. juvenile,
right.
But we're told that the first case was when he was 14 years old, which is the second case we mentioned. But
well,
it's
I mean,
the first
at 14,
case
he was
happened.
What? Over 6 feet, over 200 pounds.
Yeah, he was a big man child, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, for all the times that he's been caught, I don't know how many times he's gotten away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I mean, that's why if it wasn't for the ME's report coming out, I think Buffalo PD would have had him dead to rights.
I think so too. Especially looking through the police report. It's a thorough report, right?
Yeah.
It's a thorough file. There are tons and tons and tons of reports, tons
right.
of memos. It's thorough. Those investigators were doing a terrific job up until Dr. Virtus signed off and three other MEs for some unknown reason signed off that
yeah.
Amanda's death was an accident.
You know, and I know we're not going to say any names, but we happen to know as well that there, you know, someone from Buffalo PD told Leslie, Amanda's mom, that they were very close to arresting Garner before that ME's report came out.
Yeah. Yeah. They were just kind of dotting the I's, crossing the T's, getting ready to go. And we understand from people who were there that when the ME's report came out, there was a big outburst at the Buffalo PD. Police
right.
were angry, right? And so it was this huge outburst. So, I mean, I can't, the problem is that freaking cause of death. That is the problem.
Yeah.
And it's so, I mean, in a future episode, we're going to go over the two autopsies with a fine tooth comb, right? But
mm-hmm.
the police could have had this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is a travesty. And that's why Leslie has been tireless. I mean, you know, we joke around about how intense she is on this and how focused she is, but I mean, wouldn't you, if this were one of our daughters?
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a travesty and it needs to be fixed.
Yeah. It's difficult to understand for anybody who's not in Leslie's position, but she is so laser focused on this. Anytime I'm wondering when something happened or what are the details of that thing, I can call her and she can tell me the date.
Yeah.
She can tell me the circumstances under which she found out. She
must
tell
be exhausting.
Me everything about it.
All these years that she's had, it's just right there top of mind at all times for her. I mean, I you know, that's the other thing. By getting this thing resolved, I mean, it's, I don't know if Leslie will know what to do with herself.
Well, you know? She'll be able to rest, I hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Get I a hope good she'll be able to rest.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a horrendous situation. And you know, it's like I said, my first reaction to all of the cases with, you know, against Garner is that he's just a menace. You know, I mean, the guy, you know, he was just not good for society.
Remember that legal term, modus operandi, or MO? Antoine's MO is to rape and strangle girls and women. There's very little doubt in my mind that what happened to all these victims we talked about today, including Celeste Cerisi, is what happened to Amanda Winkowski. Shortly after charging Antoine Garner with statutory rape of a 16-year-old girl, then District Attorney Frank Sedita was asked about the obvious similarities, the MO, between that case and Amanda's. This was his response.
When I have enough evidence that is admissible in court to prove a crime has been committed and who committed that crime, we will prosecute. Unfortunately, under New York law, proof that the defendant may have committed one crime, whether it is an assault or a rape, is generally not admissible to prove that he committed a separate crime, such as homicide.
What DA Sedita said isn't technically wrong. The problem, though, is that the police were not allowed to conduct a thorough investigation into Amanda's death because they were stopped in their tracks by the district attorney's office when the medical examiner ruled her death an accidental overdose, which it obviously wasn't. At the time of Amanda's death, the Buffalo Police Department and the Erie County District Attorney's Office had an unwritten rule. BPD could only make an arrest if the DA said they could. And we learned this when we found a letter from BPD Captain Michael McCarthy to Buffalo Police Commissioner Daniel Durenda on January 16th, 2013.
Sir, Chief Richards and me will be meeting with DA Frank Sedita and ADA James Bargnesi, along with several of their investigators this afternoon. We are going to discuss a range of topics that may assist homicide investigations. This meeting was requested by the DA's office following the Buffalo News article that was obviously perceived by the DA's office as derogatory. I respectfully request to speak on behalf of the BPD regarding specifically the arrangement that developed over the years that now has our department requesting when we can arrest an individual. I believe that we must work together, but we have different thresholds for arrest and prosecution. Police threshold for arresting individuals is probable cause. The DA's needs beyond a reasonable doubt for conviction/plea. This idea that we would work in unison years ago is something that is necessary, but the pendulum has swung way too far in that we now need their authorization and permission to make an arrest. This must change. We will continue to work together on cases, but they will not dictate how our department operates. I respectfully request permission to change this unwritten policy and alter this agreement to a more reasonable agreement. I will await your decision. Thank you for your time to consider this very important matter.
This well-intended arrangement resulted in investigators reallocating their time, effort, and budgets to cases that the DA determined were prosecutable. Everything else was put on the back burner. So for District Attorney Frank Sedita to cry that he can't prosecute a case because he doesn't have the evidence, but it is his office that directly impedes police from conducting the investigations that will uncover the evidence that he needs, would be laughable if it weren't so tragic. Amanda Winkowski, according to pathologist Sylvia Comparini, was strangled and beaten to death. She was last seen entering Antoine Garner's house. She had Antoine Garner's DNA on her body, the DNA of a known rapist and strangler of women. If the police continue to be impeded from doing a proper investigation, we'll never truly know if it was Antoine Garner who killed her, and Amanda Winkowski will never get justice. Now, you might be asking yourself right now, what can I do to help? The answer is to join Amanda's army. We need you to go to our website, solvecrimeswithrickandgavin.com, and browse to Amanda's case page. Once you're there, you'll see an orange Join Now button at the top of the page. We need you to click on that and input your name and email address on the page that loads. And then we'll let you know when we need you to take action to help us pressure the DA's office to reopen Amanda's case. And thank you for considering joining Amanda's army. This is Solve Crimes with Rick and Gavin.